Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
This is episode 345. Welcome back to the show. This week on the program, we've got a couple papers for you, and just right off the top, I want to say thank you so much to everybody who has been picking up the new book I co-authored with worshipful brother John T. Ruark. It's Business Time, Adapting a Corporate Path for Freemasonry. We put a lot of thought into how to adapt corporate policies that have been successful and adapt them for Freemasonry. To make Freemasonry more successful, we can look at business practices and see how we can adapt those things to make them work in the fraternity. And that's what we did. So a huge thanks goes out to everybody for helping make that book a large success. We were number one in several different categories over the last few weeks. So just a huge thanks to everybody. Secondly, I wanted to mention thank you to everybody who went and checked out the Great Books program through the Intellectual Linear Progression run by Brother Scott Hambrick. It's a wonderful opportunity, and I'm hoping that you guys get something great out of this. If you missed sign up this time, please check it out, and we'll make sure we let everybody know when enrollment reopens. If you guys missed the Masonic Roundtable last week, we had a wonderful guest on, Brother Angel Millar. We talked about the secret tradition. It was a great episode. Angel always has some great things to share with us. Thanks goes out to him. And if you guys get a shot, please check that out. And before I go any further, how about last week's episode? George R. Adams talking about truth. Such an epic episode. And I have his book. We talked about how it was out of print, right? Well, George actually grabbed a copy of his book and he got it to me. It's autographed and it can be yours. Here's what I want you to do. Get on social media, whether it's our Facebook page, Twitter, or Instagram, whatever it is, on Tumblr even. Respond to the post that we put up about George's book. So look for a post from us that's got George's book's picture, a trilogy, Inner Journey to the East, Meditations of a Master Mason Along the Way, and Masonry for the Millennium. So it's just that easy. Here's the deal. Just tell us how you use meditations and reflections in your techniques, and I'll pick a winner on the 24th, and I'll send a copy of the book to you, autographed by illustrious brother George R. Adams, past Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of the District of Columbia. So really excited about that. I'm going to be able to get that out to you guys. So let's hear it, guys. How do you use meditations and reflections? All right, now let's get into this week's first piece. It comes to us courtesy of Masonic World, and it's called The Anti-Masonic Propaganda, The Myth of the Judeo-Masonic Conspiracy by worshipful brother A. Israel Master. Most of us are not in the craft very long when we start to become aware of the large number of anti-Masonic sentiments which are constantly circulating. These statements invariably have two things in common. One, they come from somebody who has little or no real knowledge of or exposure to the craft and its workings. And two, they are always attributed to quote-unquote reliable sources and someone who really knows. My personal experiences began shortly after my initiation when I was congratulated by a non-Masonic employee who at the same time informed me that he had it from a very reliable source that it was quote-unquote impossible to get into business in Taupo unless you are a Freemason. The English wife of a good friend told me that after an accident sustained whilst driving in England, she had been charged with a motoring offense and, though innocent, had been convicted because the driver of the other vehicle was a Freemason and the magistrate was one also. Doubtless all members who have belonged to the craft for any length of time will have had similar experiences. These examples, however, are mere word-of-mouth hearsay, which, in many cases, evoke only amusement from most of the listeners, both within and outside of the craft. Of a far more serious nature are anti-Masonic statements, which are given the stamp of authority because they are made by those who hold responsible positions. These statements are reported in otherwise reputable news media, which the non-discerning public does not normally question. It must be acknowledged that, to the majority of the public, news media statements in either printed or broadcast form are accepted without question and recapitulated with the thought, quote-unquote, it must be true, I read it in the paper or heard it on TV. In these days of mass communication, where news media are reaching a public of unprecedented size, when sensationalism and the marketing of the product is of greater importance than the veracity of the content, and where, to paraphrase an oft-quoted statement, only the facts have been changed to make a good story, we are facing a growing flood of anti-Masonic propaganda. There are few ills in our world today, the cause of which Masonic detractors do not lay at the door of the craft. In 1978, when I was in the chair of the lodge in Kaminawa, I attended an evangelist meeting in Tokoroa in the company of my deputy master, Worshipful Brother Stan McCash, and the late Worshipful Brother Jack Matthews, who at that time was master of lodge in Tokoroa. A hellfire and brimstone preacher had promised to reveal the hidden evils of Freemasonry. We were bitterly disappointed. And about the only concrete fact with which we were enlightened was his unequivocal statement that Freemasons controlled the world, economics, and more particularly the United States Treasury. As sole proof thereof, he offered the examples of the U.S. $1 bill, on the back of which is depicted both sides of a great seal of the United States. The obverse of this seal is the, of course, familiar bald eagle, with outstretched wings, arrows in one claw, and an olive branch in the other. The reverse is less well known, and the only place that this appears is on the back of the $1 bill. It depicts an unfinished pyramid with 13 rows of stones portraying the Union being watched over by the all-seeing eye of God, which is contained within the triangle. This symbol, he assured us, was proof positive of Masonic control of the United States monetary system. Earlier this year, we were treated to a newspaper report of a recently published book by Stephen Knight, which claims to document and prove the subversive activities of the potential dangers of the craft. This was featured in the Wellington Evening Post under the arresting headline "Freemasonry Used for Soviet Spying Author," and in the Auckland Star under the equally eye-catching "Freemasonry Claimed KGB Stronghold." In the column Nutshells, NZ Herald, there appeared a quote from a statement made by the Iranian Minister of Islamic Guidance, Ayatollah Doai, that, quote, "The press is the most dangerous arm in the contemporary world. Freedom of the press is an invention of Jews, Freemasons, and colonialists, and a means of sowing dissension among the disinherited." End quote. Much of this type of anti-Masonic propaganda bears a similar hallmark, the fixation of the concept that Freemasonry is, in fact, a worldwide conspiracy bent on the total behind-the-scenes control for its own ends. Whence comes this insidious myth, this portrayal of Freemasonry as a gigantic octopus moving with unseen malevolence through the corridors of power, manipulating and scheming and forever growing? For the answer to this question, we must go back to the late 18th century. 1797, a French Jesuit, the Abbé Barruel, wrote in his memoir Pour Savoir l'Histoire du Jacques Aubinisme, which was a monumental opus of 5 volumes, that the French Revolution was the carefully orchestrated fulfillment of an ancient conspiracy of what he considered the most secret of all secret societies. Barruel claimed that the medieval order of the Templars, a surviving relic of the Crusades, had not really been successfully abolished by papal decree in 1312, but had survived as a clandestine organization preaching unrestricted liberty to all people, dedicated to the overthrow of all monarchies and the papacy, and to the foundation of the world republic controlled by the Templars themselves. He further postulated that since that time it had, in the implementation of that policy, been responsible for a large number of political assassinations and, in the 18th century, had taken over control of the Order of Freemasons. It had, according to Barruel, established in 1763 a secret literary academy, among whose members were such free-thinking liberals as Turgot, Voltaire, and Robespierre. These men, meeting in the house of Baron de Holbach, published tracts and pamphlets which had, he claimed, resulted in the deterioration of morality and religion among the French. It had furthermore, from 1776, created a gigantic revolutionary organization involving 500,000 Frenchmen who were the Jacobins of the Revolution. At the center of the conspiracy were the Bavarian Illuminati led by Adam Weishaupt, whom Barruel describes as, quote, "enemies of the human race, sons of Satan," end quote. All the Freemasons and Jacobins in France, he claimed, already owed complete blind obedience to that small band of Germans who, he felt, would, unless stopped, completely control the world. Barruel's claim that the French Revolution was the result of a conspiracy dating back to the 14th century is so fanciful as to be unworthy of any effort of rebuttal. As regard that little-known German group called the Illuminati, they were in fact rivals of the Freemasons and had been dissolved in 1786, 3 years prior to the French Revolution. He had greatly oversimplified and exaggerated the role of the Freemasons. Without doubt, they were numbered amongst those who concern for humanitarian reform assisted in creating the climate leading to the revolution. They had already contributed to the abolition of witchcraft trials and of judicial torture. On the other hand, most French Freemasons were monarchists. Louis XVI and his brothers were all Freemasons. And during the mass execution which followed the revolution, Freemasons were guillotined by the hundred and their order, the Grand Orient, was suppressed. Farewell's work in its original uninspiring and clearly erroneous form would doubtless not have long survived the death of its author in 1820, and would have vanished into richly merited obscurity. It was prevented from so doing by the mischance which associated with another equally scurrilous and equally false defamatory fabrication of a sick mind. I refer to the infamous Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The scope and time available for this paper simply does not permit a detailed discussion of the origins and evolution of this work. In brief, they consist of rabidly anti-Semitic document purporting to be the blueprint for a Jewish plot to take over the world. The earliest traceable source of this myth is contained in a letter received by Baruel from Florence in 1806. This was ostensibly written by an army officer, one J.B. Simonini, of whom nothing else is known, and with whom even Baruel himself failed to establish contact. This letter appears to be the first in a line of anti-Semitic forgeries which were to culminate in the Protocols. In it, the author commences by first congratulating Baruel on having, quote-unquote, unmasked the hellish sects which are preparing the way for the Antichrist, and then goes on to draw, Baruel, its attention to the, quote, Judaic wealth and the protection it enjoys in almost all European countries, end quote. The mysterious Simonini permits his imagination to run riot. He claims to have penetrated to the center of a Jewish conspiracy and to have discovered that, amongst other things, the founders of Freemasonry and of the Illuminati were both Jewish, although the founders of both are known and neither were founded by Jews, that in Italy alone over 800 ecclesiastics were Jews, and ranked among their number were bishops and cardinals, and would shortly include a pope. All of this is, of course, self-evidently spurious. At the time of the Simonini letter, many lodges were still practicing a ritual highly Christian in character, and many others were still reluctant to accept Jewish members. Jews or persons of Jewish descent have never occupied a disproportionate place in Freemasonry. These are established facts, but nonetheless, the basis of the myth of the Judeo-Masonic conspiracy was born. Baruel had shown, at least to his own satisfaction, that the French Revolution was the result of a conspiracy of Freemasons. The increasing freedom from discrimination against religious minorities which followed the revolution was clearly to the advantage of the Jews. No further evidence was required to demonstrate to these somewhat less than unbiased critics that Freemasons and Jews were closely associated in a worldwide Judeo-Masonic conspiracy. The twisted logic of the combination of Baruel's imagination and the Simonini letter aroused little public interest in the first half of the 19th century, until in the 1860s Hermann Gudschah, a discredited former employee of the Prussian Postal Service, had been sacked for forgery, commenced writing novels under the pseudonym of Sir John Retcliffe. In one of these novels, Biarritz, an eerie scene in the macabre style of Edgar Allan Poe is recounted, set in a Jewish cemetery in Prague. The scene portrays how at midnight on the Feast of the Tabernacles, representatives of the 12 tribes of Israel hold conversation with the satanic presence emanating from a tomb. These representatives report on the progress they have made towards fulfillment of the aims of their conspiracy for world domination. The novel Biarritz was published in 1868 in the anti-Semitic climate existing in Germany after a partial emancipation of the Jews. This is merely the start of the saga. At this point, we are discussing a novel, a work of fiction only. Soon, however, this clearly fictional chapter, taken out of the framework of the novel, begins to turn into a forged document. Russian anti-Semites published the relevant chapter in 1872 in St. Petersburg in the form of a pamphlet which, although bearing the comment that it was a work of fiction, stated that it had a basis in fact. In 1876, it appeared in a similar publication in Moscow under the title, quote, In the Jewish Cemetery in Czech Prague, The Jews, Sovereigns of the World, end quote. In 1880, a second edition was issued, and similar items appeared in Odessa and Prague. In 1881, it arrived in France, printed in Le Contemporain. At this point, no reference is made to it being a work of fiction. It has now become established fact. All the speeches supposedly made by the 12 representatives in the cemetery in Prague were combined into a single speech ostensibly made by a chief rabbi to a secret meeting of the Jews. The authenticity of the speech is vouched for by an imaginary English diplomat. After all, all. Who would dare doubt the word of an Englishman? And indeed is claimed as an extract from his projected book. Goodshay had originally written his novel, from which this work had been extracted, under the pseudonym of Sir John Redcliffe. Perhaps not surprisingly, the imaginary English diplomat is given the name Sir John Redcliffe. When, in 1896, François Bernand printed the so-called speech in Les Juifs et nos Contemporains, it is attributed to Chief Rabbi John Redcliffe. Further editions followed and found fertile ground in the superstitiously gullible minds of the populace not far removed from a generally accepted belief in witchcraft, werewolves, and sorcery. Its many translations spread throughout Europe under a variety of titles, including one which appeared in 1906 with the title Extracts from the Protocols of the Freemasons. Although the protocols themselves, in the standard version, are only 24 in number and contain only passing reference to Freemasonry, they are invariably published with a commentary proving and justifying their veracity. The two English editions each comprise about 100 small pages. These Freemasonic references, albeit small, when conjoined in the reader's mind by the anti-Masonic pronouncements included in the commentaries, are sufficient to create the implication of a great Judeo-Masonic conspiracy. One such example will suffice when Murin, in his version entitled La Franque Maconnière, Synagogue de Satan, said, quote, "Everything in Freemasonry is fundamentally Jewish, exclusively Jewish, passionately Jewish from the beginning to the end," end quote. Later in the same publication, he says, quote, "The fact that all revolutions are made in the depths of the Masonic back lodges would be inexplicable if we did not know that the ministries of all the countries are in the hands of Freemasons who, in the last analysis, are controlled by Jews," end quote. Murin has further, quote-unquote, facts to reveal about these back lodges. They consist of Freemasons and Jews of the 33rd degree. The protocols themselves end with the words signed by the representatives of the Zion of the 33rd degree, end quote. This allusion to the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite is clear. This particular Freemasonic system, which originated in the United States in 1801 and thence spread with great rapidity to many countries, has as its highest rank the title of Sovereign Grand Inspector General, which is, in fact, the 33rd degree of the Order of Freemasonry. We, as citizens of a liberal democracy, which has for some generations prided itself on the quality and universality of its educated systems, are hard put to comprehend the impact of these doctrines could have on superstitious, largely illiterate populations. It must be emphasized that these publications were not merely a solitary outburst by few sensation-seeking individuals. They were published in literally hundreds of editions, translated into scores of languages: Russian, German, Polish, French, Romanian, Czech, Yugoslav, Greek, Italian, Portuguese, Dutch, Swedish, Norwegian, and of course English, to name a few. A generation ago, one authority, Henry Rollin, author of L'Apocalypse de Notre Temps, reckoned that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, in all its various forms, was probably the most widely distributed book in the world after the volume of Sacred Law. It has served as the justification of most of the anti-Semitic and anti-Masonic steps taken by totalitarian governments in the last 150 years, culminating, of course, in the well-documented excess of one Adolf Hitler toward both Masons and, of course, the Jewish population. The evil potential of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion should never be underestimated. Well, there you have that wonderful piece explaining this terrible text, and you can't help but see how this played into the hands of the anti-Semitic movements that swept across Europe in those days, and eventually even made their way into the United States. And it's just an absolutely terrible piece of propaganda, but it's important that we talk about it so that we don't forget it. All right, before we move on, I need to ask everybody and remind them just how we produce this show. So we make this show possible through donations made by you, the listener, or through the sale of some of our pins, our cufflinks, money clips and tie bars, and of course we have our Mason's Lady sticker. I should say, unless I find another bag of pins laying around somewhere, I think I only have like 21 pins left. I've got two sets of cufflinks and I've got about six money clips. I have zero tie bars left, and I think I've got about 10 or 15 Mason's Lady stickers. So if you're wanting some of that stuff, now is the time to get it. Don't wait, because again, I have a very limited supply, and if I do find more pins, I'll probably find a bag of 80 or so, and those go pretty fast. So thanks to anybody out there who is picking up their awesome lapel pin, 24 karat gold plating, hard fired colored enamel, strong butterfly clasp on the back, and it has endless symbolism. No less than 12 pieces of symbolism, which span the gamut from craft masonry to the York Rite, all the way into the higher grades in Freemasonry. And of course, it is all about listener funded Masonic education. We did get our coupon code back over at Onnit Labs, so if you hover over Support the Show and then click on Get Onnit or Alpha Brain, you can click on the link there and use the promo code WCY at checkout, and you'll get 10% off your order. My favorite thing from them is Alpha Brain, as I've talked about before. Whether you get Onnit's Alpha Brain capsules or you get the instant powder, both are awesome. Increased focus, all natural, so there's not even dye in the capsules. Vegan approved, promotes lucid dreaming, heightened awareness, and the best thing of all is there's no caffeine, so it's not like an artificial buzz or anything. So check that out. And of course, one of our best sponsors in the whole world, Brother Levi Banker of Banker's Best. So you can either go to WCYpodcast.com, hover over Banker's Best, and click through our links, or you can go to buybankersbest.com, use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, and you're going to get a good percentage off. We have some exclusive collaborative items that we've worked on together. You've heard me talk about it before, the beard balm and the beard oil. Both of those, 50% of the profits go right back to this show, so it's a great way to support the program. But that's not the only thing that Brother Levi carries. He's got lip balms and beard oils, and they're all great stuff. And you can trust it. I've sat down with Levi myself. We've talked about quality and how much it matters to him. And there's some similar brands out there. This is the real deal. So if you check it out again, it's Banker's Best or Buy Banker's Best. And use the promo code BBWCY357. So next I was going to read a piece that I wrote. However, I think I found another piece that we're going to go with this week. And that is called Motivation of Lodge Members in Masonic Activities. This is by Right Worshipful Brother Ronald A. Brinkman, Grand Secretary of New Mexico. This paper has been adapted from a paper given at the Southwest Masonic Conference several years ago by Right Worshipful Brother Brinkman. His enthusiasm, optimism, and action is contagious. We thank him for sharing these thoughts, which motivation is the word. It is hoped this paper will create interest, debate, discussion, and possibly even a good argument, whereby together we may begin to see the light that surely appears at the end of the dark tunnel through which our craft seems to be traveling. Motivation implies movement. It means the difference in getting up and doing something rather than just sitting there and doing nothing or letting something else do it. That is apathy and indifference. Webster defines motivation as causing or having the power to cause motion, an impulse from within. If we feel, as we say we do regarding our fraternity, let's do something rather than just talk about it and appoint a committee to report back next year and the next. This conference has been meeting for 28 years. Numerous subjects have been presented in that time, covering various areas of our operation. Many have skirted declining numbers, indifferent leadership, and so on. But I found none which said directly, "Hey, we have a real problem. Let's do something now." Some time ago, Chief Justice Warren Burger, in addressing the American Bar Association, quoted the great Masonic writer and jurist Dean Roscoe Pound of the Harvard Law School as saying in 1906, quote, "The courts of the 20th century cannot operate on the laws of the 19th century," end quote. My brethren, are we so operating? At this conference and others around the nation through the years, including the conferences of Grand Masters, many speakers have been saying or implying that we are not concerned about numbers, that we want quality in our ranks. This has been so often repeated that it sounds a little like a small boy who said, "I don't believe in ghosts, but I'm still afraid of them." The fear of change does strange things to people. It has been known to close their eyes, tie their hands, and stop them from thinking. No one seems to want to rock the boat. Perhaps it is time that we do a little rocking. He who was called a radical a few years ago is rapidly becoming just another old conservative, a quote-unquote stick-in-the-mud. We can't do that. Why not? Well, we just never have. Well, maybe we should, or later on, we may not have the opportunity. This fraternity cannot live and thrive on the stories of its great and glorious past. If we do, we may be not long for this world. Pessimistic, you say? Well, perhaps a little. But let me tell you that for many years I have been traveling for our order, and much of my time is spent with officers and members of the local lodges, not just with those who direct and govern the policy of the Grand Lodge, and I think I see it as it really is, not as how we would like to see it. I have attended Lodge unrecognized as a Grand Lodge officer in a number of states, including yours. I have seen the problems, the challenges, at the grassroots level, and that is where we had better get the job done. We're in a rut, particularly in the rural areas. And the only difference between a rut and a grave is the depth of the hole. If our efforts have failed in the past, perhaps we are fortunate. Now we know something of the things not to do. We have a lodge that finally presented a 50-year pin to a past Grand Lodge officer over 2 years late at the insistence of those in authority. Another case where the past due recipient was hospitalized, then died before they got around to presenting the pin. This is our dirty laundry, of which we are not proud. Perhaps your jurisdiction has some of the same. For a number of years, surveys have been made into the challenges of our time. A few years ago, I had the privilege of serving on a membership committee which studied conditions in our jurisdiction for a year and then reported at Grand Lodge. We found many things we considered wrong and poorly handled. We endeavored to tell it like it is, without pretty phrases. Finally, we concluded with a number of suggestions. Now, several years later, none of these 14 ideas are by and large being used by lodges. Nor did the Grand Lodge take any action where possible legislation was indicated. North Carolina is one of those jurisdictions where gains were continuing and conditions appeared healthy. A past Grand Master, William Hooks, in addressing the shrine, gave two reasons for part of their status. One, minimizing the secret aspects of our order to the public, and secondly, the unity and mutual cooperation between craft masonry and the appendant bodies. He has said that the latter is a must. Many of you, perhaps a majority, are members of, have been active in, and honored by one or more of the various bodies that predicate membership on the Blue Lodge. However, in my travels, I often observe that many such brethren are too busy to lend their time, their talents, efforts, and attendance at functions of the Mother Lodge, from whom their organizations derive candidates. I heard of a potentate who asked his nobles to humble themselves and attend Blue Lodge. A Grand Master of California scheduled several area meetings throughout his state to which were invited the Master Masons who had been raised in his year. At each meeting, the Grand Master explained the relationship between Grand Lodge and the Constituent Lodge and covering the activities and programs of the various committees of the Grand Lodge. He also gave each group a brief history of Masonry in that jurisdiction and then advised them as to their duties and responsibilities to their lodge and their brethren in Freemasonry. Apparently these new brethren were eager to learn more of our craft, as in many cases the meetings were prolonged by many questions asked of Grand Master. When a new Mason is motivated to learn more about our organization, often some Lodge officers or Grand Lodge officer has been directly responsible. The need for the interested candidate is always with us. It always has been. If every petitioner was as enthusiastic as we would have him, there would be no hue and cry about declines, attendance, and Masonic education, for there are always those who of their own accord seek knowledge, light, and education. The problem, then, is to extend our circle of light further into the multitude of our membership. One of the best ways to do this is by example. Let our light really shine in all places and at all times. As stated by Most Worshipful Brother Hooks, quote, "We should tell the world what Freemasonry is, what it teaches, what it stands for, and we should get the message across to every Mason in the Grand Jurisdiction," end quote. A few years ago, at this conference, Right Worshipful Claude Austin, past Grand Master of Texas, commented, quote, "Let's put some of this talk into action. We need action. I'd rather see a sermon than to hear one any day. I'd rather one would walk with me than merely show the way. I can soon learn how to do it if you will let me see it done," end quote. How many times in the 28 years of this conference have we gone home and seen to it that each of the newspapers in our major cities of our five states have been given extensive coverage about what Masons are trying to do for the good of our nation, mankind in general, and what we really stand for? Success in the business world is based on motivation. These same factors can be applied to Masonry, where the wages are satisfaction, pride in a job well done, the inner glow of personal accomplishment, and something good done for one's fellow man. Efficiency is a dandy word for the other fellow, but let's put on that hat ourselves and start where we should start, with number one, me. All the Masonic education and candidate training available will not help if we, at this level, do not implement it in the lodges which think they have neither the know-how nor personnel to get the messages across. So take the easy way out and do nothing. Sometimes these lodges feel alone. and not really an integral part of our Masonic family. I believe that some change in this area is a must. It is results that count, not oratory at conferences at the Grand Lodge. Efficiency takes imagination, and imagination goes hand in hand with initiative. Imagination is not necessarily being far out and impossible. Imagination can be the difference between routine and real progress. Originate and invent ideas, and then give them a hell of a try. Nearly everything in our modern world today is the result of imagination. Technology, medicine, spaceflight, communication, that which is now in use was once only imagined. Action is the key word, and enthusiasm is necessary to create action. Let's get a piece of the action, our own action, if you please, and create the action, not wait for it to come to us. Let's stop talking high-sounding phrases and do something now. I first said that I couldn't tell you how to motivate, but hoped to stir you enough to stand on your own hind legs and discuss the ideas, for it is ideas that motivate action. If I have accomplished nothing more than a good debate today, I am satisfied and rewarded. My brethren, I'm a little like the lad digging frantically in the large manure pot. With all of this here for me to dig in, there must be a pony somewhere. For years, I have been accused of being an enthusiastic, cockeyed optimist. Well, maybe I am, but I just can't believe that all of this talent can or will permit our beloved fraternity to become second-rate or sink to oblivion. Are you a Master Mason? The candidate answered enthusiastically, I am. If you were brought to trial for being a Mason, would there be enough evidence to convict you? All right, that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed the program. If you have an affinity for things like this, please don't forget to check out the Masonic Roundtable going live every Tuesday night at 10, 9 Central. If you like reading, please check out the Midnight Freemasons, where we publish 3 articles every single week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Please don't forget to check out WCYpodcast.com. Support the show through any means possible, and check out the new book, It's Business Time, Adapting a Corporate Path for Freemasonry. And of course, if you want access to the documents we read on the show, please go and download the podcast. Source links are on our website under Where to Listen. Download the Podcast Source app, search for Whence Came You. Once in the app, you can search for Whence Came You and add it to your list of shows, and you will have access to our weekly Masonic wallpapers as well as the papers we read on the show. And please don't forget to let us know how meditations and reflections work for you on our posts and social media. We'll search for all the answers, we'll find them, compile them, and we'll pick one answer. One person will receive an autographed copy of The Inner Journey to the East, Meditations of a Master Mason Along the Way, Masonry for the Millennium, a trilogy by most worshipful and illustrious Brother George R. Adams, past Grand Master of the District of Columbia. It is the limited Millennium Edition. So, with all that, I hope you thoroughly enjoyed. I will talk to you all next week. Thank you so much for allowing me to bring you Masonic education in this format. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.